from Cardiff University, the Center for Critical and Cultural Theory here, and so I guess I feel that my paper may be the most theoretical one. But even though the philosophy is not, let's say, my home field, I'll try to do some philosophical discussions here about Heidegger, who's not my favorite thinker anyway. So Heidegger's lizard is a reference to one of his famous examples that he has in the fundamental concept of metaphysics. And I got this image from this book, which is called The Death of the Animal, edited by Paolo Cavalieri. And they reference this lizard in the book, so I think I'm pretty sure it's a reference. The cover is a reference to that. So I would like to discuss the famous example employed by Heidegger in the fundamental concept of metaphysics that illustrates his discussion of the difference between humans and animals. He's attempting to determine how humans and animals relate differently to the world, and his example is a lizard lying on a rock, basking in the sun. So I will try to explore the importance of the lizard as a cold-blooded animal for his example, as well as the rhetorical weight of the sun as part of this example, and also in relation to the cold-bloodedness of the lizard. I will summarize very briefly his arguments and his line of thoughts until he arrives at the lizard example, so you can, let's say, see why he's using it. And then I will relate that to some of Derrida's writing about the sun. So this was my attempt of tackling the issue of cold-bloodedness as such, let's say. So not I wouldn't want to talk about an animal that happened to be cold-blooded. I want to talk about cold-bloodedness itself. So that's what I came up with. So according to Matthew Calarco, which I'm sure you know, Heidegger's work is in its entirety concerned in some level with this question of the animal, the difference between human and animal. But according to Calarco, the difference between human and animal relation to the world is the most recurrent and most detailed aspect of this discussion of the human-animal difference. So in the fundamental concept of metaphysics, Heidegger enters in the discussion of the meaning of world, after having identified this as a crucial question in his analysis of boredom. Most of the book is about boredom. Unsurprisingly, he believes boredom is an exclusively human sensation. And it's interesting that this question, whether animals can get bored, it crops up in popular media from time to time. But Heidegger had his opinion ages ago. This essay is from the 1930. It was given as a lecture. So Heidegger does review his other works where he has written on world in order to contrast those with the methodological approach he's employing in the fundamental concepts. And that is a comparative examination. So here starts off with a threefold thesis, which is very famous. The stone is worldless, the animal is poor in world, and man is world-forming. So by comparing and contrasting these three different relations to world, he hopes to find the essence of world. So he admits, firstly, that we would need to know the difference between human and animal to start discussing the thesis. So he writes, "It is easy to say that man is a rational living being while the animal is a non-rational living being." So that's an easy start. But then he asks, what does reason or the lack of reason actually mean here? So he believes these distinctions are at bottom irrelevant, since he writes that what matters is finding out what constitutes the essence of the animality of the animal and the essence of the humanity of man. So really humble. So his thesis about the animal's poverty in world in no way stems from zoology, he tells us. Rather, this proposition is a presupposition of zoology, since it serves to delimit its very scope as a science by determining what animals are in the first place. So for Heidegger, his thesis is a statement of essence and not of fact. But then he asks regarding the thesis. Remember the thesis about stones, animals, and people. So he asks himself, what possible criterion do we then possess for the truth of our thesis? Where do we draw that thesis from in the first place? Is it an arbitrary one or is it a hypothesis? It is neither of these. The proposition does not derive from zoology, but it cannot be elucidated independently of zoology either. It requires a specific orientation towards ology and biology in general, and yet it is not through them that its truth is to be determined. However, we cannot analyze this relationship more closely at this juncture. So I believe this passage reveals, let's say, this lack of evidence and foundation for his distinctions. So he does this, he has these disclaimers, but his proposition comes across as an axiom or a hypothesis. Further, he warns that the thesis may sound like all three types of beings, stones and animals and people, are in the same order, which is misleading. He hopes to show that they are essentially different by starting from the middle, that is, by beginning with a discussion with the animal's relation to world, and then comparing starting with the animals and then comparing the stones' relation and man's relation to world. It shouldn't come as a surprise that we find here a problematic, undecidable middle ground, the animal, between two comparatively simpler elements, the stone and man. This three-part structure with a confusing chimeric middle element, it recurs throughout Heidegger's essay. And in The Open by George Agamben, this middle element, it resurfaces many times in other three-part figures. For example, when he discusses the anthropological machine. And Timothy Morton's Ecology Without Nature talks a lot about this, when he talks about nature being suspended between two states. So Heidegger bases a lot of his discussion on von Eschkill's work on ethology. So he was a Baltic German ethologist who influenced Heidegger a lot. So Heidegger defends that animals live in an environment, which in German is Umwelt, which is meaningful to them, but they are still poor in world. So there's a difference between Umwelt, environment, and Welt, which is world. He concedes that the word poverty, as opposed to richness, implies a sense of less, which is obvious. There are less elements in an animal's environment than in humans' world. Also, animals penetrate their Umwelt less than we are able to penetrate the beings that make up our world. Also, humans can extend the richness and variety of their world, of our world. And that's why we are world foreign. So he says, as against the animal's Umwelt, the world of man is a rich one, greater in range, far more extensive in its penetrability, constantly extendable not only in its range, we can always bring more and more beings into consideration, but also in respect to the manner in which we penetrate ever more deeply in this penetrability. Okay? So it's very repetitive most of the time. Heidegger abandons this line of thinking after mentioning examples of animal organs which are clearly more discerning than ours. So he talks about the dog's nose and the falcon's eyes. He dismisses the possibility of hierarchization between lesser and greater richness. So he states this, but then he abandons. So in fact, even among animals, he is against the hierarchy. So he writes, it is a fundamental mistake to suppose that amoeba or infusoria are more imperfect or incomplete animals than elephants or apes. Every animal and every species of animal as such is just as perfect and complete as any other. Thus, this talk of poverty in world and world formation must not be taken as a hierarchical evaluation. End quote. So it is very paradoxical. So it is poverty, but it must not be thought as less rich. So ultimately, he argues, being poor means being deprived. End fail. So this is obscure. He concedes that he uses word, this is obscure, and he believes that this poverty does not mean a quantitative difference. This connects again to what he called an essential abyssal difference between humans and animals. Okay, I'm getting to the list. So poverty thus means that not having a world. But so does worldlessness of the stone, which is not like an animal. Poverty means a deprivation of world, whereas worldlessness, he writes, is constitutive of the stone in the sense that the stone cannot even be deprived of something like world. End quote. So he begins to propose images and examples to clarify this distinction. A stone lying on the ground, for example, can be said to be touching the earth. But it touches the ground in a different sense than the regular stronger meaning of touch. He then introduces the lizard to make that point. He writes, the stone touching the earth is not at all like that relationship which the lizard has to the stone on which it lies, basking in the sun. End quote. But then, of course, comes another distinction. When he says that the touching implied in both these cases is above all not the same as that touch which we experience when we rest our hand upon the head of another human being. So there are three different kinds of touching. The stone, therefore, cannot sense the earth as such. The earth is not given to the stone. Everything is inaccessible to a stone. The lizard, on the other hand, actually sought the stone on which it lies and is there intentionally. Since it's basking on the sun, as Heidegger informed us, we can assume that it has intentionally sought the stone precisely in order to expose itself to the sun and thus get warmer. Actually, we don't have to assume, because Heidegger suggests that we play around with the lizard in this experiment. He says, if we now remove the lizard from its stone, it does not simply lie wherever we have put it, but starts looking for its stone again, irrespective of whether or not it actually finds it. So therefore, no, the lizard will not just stand there, or lie there, where you put it, just like a stone. It will presumably want to resume sunning. We'll look for the stone again. So he describes one more time the lizard trying to get to the bottom of the thought of experiment. The lizard basks in the sun. At least this is how we describe what it is doing, although it is doubtful whether it really comports itself in the same way we do when we lie out in the sun. And this is like the core of his argument, i.e. whether the sun is accessible to it, to the lizard as sun, whether the lizard is capable of experiencing the rock as rock. So, it's not certain that lizards can access the rock or the sun as such. That's a very recurring expression. So up to now, there were three elements in the image: the stone, the lizard, and the sun. The first two, the stone and the lizard, they were part of the topic of the initial thesis about stones, animals, and man. While the sun represents what I argue to be a privileged element in the world, or the umwelt, of these subjects. So he suggests now that we introduce a fourth character, let's say, a human. So imagine a human and a lizard lying on a rock, or two different rocks, which is lying on the ground. So the human, the lizard, and the rock are all exposed to the sun. The sun warms the stone, it's clear, but the stone knows nothing of this. The lizard can feel the warmth of the sun and that of the rock when it gets warmed up, but Heidegger doubts that the lizard does so in the same way as a human. So firstly, it does not do that in the same way as a human. It doesn't sound controversial. Of course the lizard comports itself differently to lying in the sun. It is, after all, a cold-blooded animal, so its entire relationship to the sun must be radically different from ours. Lizards have, as it were, a much more intimate relationship to the sun than us, because, you know, we're not cold-blooded. So, of course, then there's another distinction, which Heidegger usually plays with different German words, because behaving, benehmen, is not the same as comporting oneself, verhalten. Only humans can comport themselves towards things. And that it means accessing them in their being. So humans and lizards behave in a certain way to the sun. And maybe the lizard behavior to the sun is more meaningful than ours. But we comport ourselves to the sun on top of our behavior. We have behavior and comportment. And the lizard cannot do that. The lizard, so he explains the inability of the lizard to access the sun. Thus, this is how he describes. It is true that the rock on which the lizard lies is not given for the lizard as rock, in such a way that it could inquire into its mineralogical constitution, for example. It is true that the sun in which it is basking is not given for the lizard as sun, in such a way that it could ask questions of astrophysics about it and expect to find answers. The lizard has its own relation to the rock, to the sun, and to a host of other things, unlike a stone. One is tempted to suggest that what we identify as the rock and the sun are just lizard things for the lizard, so to speak. When we say that the lizard is lying on the rock, we ought to cross out the word rock in order to indicate that whatever the lizard is lying on is certainly given in some way for the lizard, and yet is not known to the lizard as a rock. If we cross out the word, we imply that whatever it is not accessible to it as a being. So he goes on to say that, for example, for a beetle, walking on a blade of grass, it's like a beetle path, towards beetle nourishment. So it's all very don't know, sounds like Batman things, you know, like everything's Batman. So the lizard lies in the sun on a rock, supposedly next to the human. We learn from Heidegger about the lizard's relation both to the sun and to the rock, but never to the human. So the lizard's relation both to the rock and to the sun, they seem important to the argument. But there's a difference. The rock was already part of the discussion, right? It was one of the characters of the three-part thesis. The sun is not a character. The sun is not alive, but it never joins the rock, the stone, as you know, a non-living being. The sun, in a way, is the world. In the thought experiment, the sun is there as a stand-in for the world, for environmentality itself. And the relation to the sun will come up in the rest of the essay when he talks about bees and the way the bees find their hives. So it's very important. So we can ask, why a lizard? Would Heidegger's example work the same way with a cat? So he insists he's making assertions of essence. So this should apply to the animality of all animals. But I believe an animal studies reading should disobey his methodological frame and try to attend to this materiality of the animal example. So my question is, to what extent are Heidegger's claims about cold-bloodedness? So if he wishes to foreground the sun as a privileged element of the world and as the world, does he then choose a cold-blooded animal to stress this relation to sun? Since the human obviously doesn't need the sun the same way the lizard does, is the lizard being set up to lose in this comparison? So the argument would go, the lizard's very physiology requires the sun. Therefore, there is nothing but an instinctual drive for it to seek sunny rocks. Whereas we humans can seek the sunlight for pleasure or for astrophysical inquiry. So there's, let's say, a dishonesty in the example, choosing a cold-blooded animal because it would always lose. But if the sun is the world, this is due to the fact that sun opens phenomenality itself. There can be no visibility without the sun. The sun exceeds even being equated with the world. The sun stands over the world as its founder and possibility. So Derrida has written a lot about this in Plato's Pharmacy, for example, and in White Mythology, among other essays, exploring the Platonic conception of the sun as the sensory good, which stands in the sensory world, stands for the intelligible good, which is the good, which is responsible for being to appear, makes being possible. So the sun is that which makes seeing possible and visible beings possible. So in the same way that the good makes intelligible beings available to our minds, the sun makes sensory beings available to our eyes. They are the self-effacing source of presence. That's one of Derrida's arguments. The good has the sun replace it in the world as its sensory counterpart. And the sun hides behind its blinding light, which we should not look at directly, and in eclipses, and when it sets every day. So the sun is always moving away. It inaugurates presence, but it itself absents itself. So if the sun slips away from the lizard, this occultation is therefore part of an age-old play of presence and absence. As they say, there's nothing new under the sun. So Derrida writes about the sun. The sun does not just provide an example, even if the most remarkable one, of sensory being, such that it can always disappear, keep out of sight, and not be present. The very opposition of appearing and disappearing, the entire lexicon of day and night, of the visible and the invisible, of the present and the absent, all this is only possible under the sun. And then it's important to keep in mind that White Mythology is an article about the use of metaphor in philosophy. So some people would say that philosophy are only metaphors which have lost their metaphoric meaning, so now they sound conceptual. So that's why it's called White Mythology, because philosophy would be the white man's mythology. But he's against this line of thought because metaphor is itself a philosophical concept. And that we can think about Heidegger's lizard example as a metaphor, as an analogy. So he intends to show this animal's poverty by analogy. But the problem with metaphors in philosophy, if we try to uncover their nature as metaphor, is that we always find the sun. That's Derrida's argument. All metaphor is heliotropic, and heliotrope is another name for this sunflower, right? Because it follows the sun. So he says, if we try to uncover metaphors, we discover the same thesis, the same meaning of being as presence, or amounting to the same as presence and absence, the same circle, the same fire of the same light, revealing and concealing itself, the same turn of the sun. What other than this return of the same is to be found when one seeks metaphor? There is resemblance. What other is to be found if not the metaphor of domination, heightened by its power of dissimulation, which permits it to escape mastery, like the god or the sun? Presence disappearing in its own radiance, the hidden source of light, of truth, and of meaning, the erasure of the visage of being, such must be the insistent return of that which subjects metaphysics to metaphor. And I just wanted to say that what Derrida concludes when he writes about the sun is that there can be no sun as such, because the sun always occults itself. The sun cannot be equated with the world, and not even humans would have access to the sun as such, because there is, again, no sun as such. The sun is never present. It opens presence, but it itself is absent. And then I had some, let's say, wonderings about a human in Mars, thinking about world formation as terraforming in Mars, but you can ask me questions about this. And Jovan Bauer.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Anybody have any questions?
Tell us about terraforming
and
Mars.
Okay, yes. Thank you. So, because he makes it clear that the world is not the Earth, because he provisionally defines world as everything that exists. So that would count the whole universe. But then he talks about the way that we measure time in relation to the sun. The minutes and hours are a result of our inhabiting the world, the Earth, and the sun in such a way, so that the sun and the movement of the Earth around the sun limits our world. You see, so there's an interplanetary register in the essay. So I imagine, so now there's life on Mars. So let's take this human, this design, and put him or her on Mars. So who has most access to the world of Mars, the Velt, or to the Umwelt of Mars? So would it still be easy to assume that the human would have more access? And it's mostly rocks in Mars, so maybe we'd have to talk even more about rocks. Or maybe the rover, or maybe Martian life, because even if there are only microbes in Mars, it would be a really big argument to say that humans would know Mars better than Martian microbes, you see? And then you would need terraforming, you know. So world formation, which is world forming, I think it connects a little bit with terraforming this aspect, right? Like our world is it feels ours because we have terraformed it.
Lots of hands. You want to go first, Stephen?
There's good reasons to believe that the lizard or the beetle does have a, I wouldn't say a concept, but